In this next half-hour segment, we're going to begin a reading of an article that is very important and that I think bodes very portentously and in all probability poorly for the future. One of the things that the framers of the Constitution were most afraid of was the possibility that the nation which was aborning back in the 1770s, namely the United States, might eventually come to have a professional standing army. The framers of the Constitution were opposed to the idea of a professional army. And after studying military affairs for some time, one wonders whether it's possible to have a professional standing army that is consistent with a democratic society. I'm not saying it's impossible, but the psychological pressures and sociological pressures on a military recruit, as well as on somebody that is obliged to kill and perhaps be killed, are such that there is a fundamentally alienating factor that causes a gap or precipitates a gap between the civilian and military sectors. Just such a gap, and a rapidly widening gap, and a potentially very destructive gap, was the focus of an article that appeared in the July 1997 issue of the Atlantic Monthly. This is a very important article, and it was researched for us by a listener. This article, which I'm going to read in the next couple of half-hour segments, is entitled "The Widening Gap Between the Military and Society." It's authored by Thomas E. Ricks, last name R-I-C-K-S. The article reads as follows. By the way, it's subtitled, U.S. military personnel of all ranks are feeling increasingly alienated from their own country and are becoming both more conservative and more politically active than ever before. Do they see America clearly? The article reads, after following a platoon of Marine recruits through 11 weeks of boot camp training on Paris Island in the spring of 1995, I was stunned to see, when they went home for post-graduation leave, how alienated they felt from their old lives. At various times, each of these new Marines seemed to experience a moment of private loathing for public America. They were repulsed by the physical unfitness of civilians, by the uncouth behavior they witnessed, and by what they saw as pervasive selfishness and consumerism. By the way, I would echo that I feel much the same sort of repulsion. So this is not something that's peculiar to the military, because when I read that, I said, yeah, right on. You know, that's exactly the way it is. Continuing, many found themselves avoiding old friends, and some experienced difficulty even in communicating with their families. One typical member of Platoon 3086, Craig Hoover, H-O-O-V-E-R, reported that the Amtrak ride home to Kensington, Maryland was, quote, horrible, unquote. The train was filled with smoke, he said. People were drinking and their kids were running around aimlessly. You felt like smacking around some people, unquote. An article I published in the Wall Street Journal in July of 1995 mentioned many of the recruits quoted here. Hoover also found the train ride a sad contrast to the relative racial harmony of Paris Island. Quote, it felt kind of segregated by race and class. A poor white car, a poor black car, a middle-class white car, a middle-class black car. Even McDonald's, which had become a fantasy-like symbol to the recruits as they ate military rations, particularly during a week of training in the woods, proved to be a letdown. Quote, you look around and notice that a lot of civilians are overweight and a little sloppy, unquote, Hoover said. To that I would say amen once again. Jonathan Prish, P-R-I-S-H, a former white supremacist, went with old friends to a bar in Mobile, Alabama. Quote, we played pool and drank, he reported in a typical comment. It seemed like everyone there was losers. All they wanted to do was get smashed. They're self-destructive. They're not trying. They're just goofing around, unquote. In the wealthy Washington suburb of Potomac, Maryland, Eric Didier, D-I-D-I-E-R, felt the same way. There are some friends I've stayed away from, he said. They're not going anywhere, and I don't want to be around them. We don't have any common ground, unquote. Though they are in their early 20s, he said, quote, they're not doing anything, living at home, not working, not studying, unquote. In Pittsburgh, Patrick Baton went to a Saturday night party where he saw two old friends as losers, unquote. Everything feels different, he said. I can't stand half my friends no more, unquote. Frank DeMarco attended a street fair in Bayonne, New Jersey. Quote, it was crowded, trash everywhere, people were drinking, getting into fights, people with obnoxious attitudes, no politeness whatsoever. But he said, I didn't let it get to me. I just said, this is the way civilian life is. Nasty, unquote. Yet the member of Platoon 3086, perhaps most at odds with his former environment, was Daniel Keene, K-E-A-N-E, whose background was probably the most privileged. the son of a Merrill Lynch and Company executive, Keene seemed almost in pain when I interviewed him in the living room of his parents' house in Summit, New Jersey. When he first got home from Paris Island, he said about being with his family, quote, "I didn't know how to act. They said, 'What do you do? What do you want to do?' I'd say, 'I don't know.' I didn't know how to carry on a conversation," unquote. He found his old peer group even more difficult. "All my friends are home from college now, drinking, acting stupid and loud," unquote, the 18-year-old Marine said. He was particularly disappointed when two old friends refused to postpone smoking marijuana for a few minutes until he was away from them. Quote, "They were getting ready to smoke their weed. I said, 'Could you just hang on for a minute? Can't you wait till you get to the party instead of smoking in the car?' They said, 'Then we'd have to pass it out,'" unquote. So he recalled they lit up in front of their Marine friend. "I was pretty disappointed in them doing that. It made me want to be at SOI, the Marine School of Infantry," unquote. Like many other members of 3086, Keene felt as if he had joined a cult or religion. "People don't understand," he told me, "and I'm not going to waste my breath trying to explain when the only thing that really impresses them is how much beer you can chug down in 30 seconds, unquote. The next section is called The Gap. I think the Marines of Platoon 3086 were experiencing in a very personal way the widening gap between today's military and civilian America. To be sure, their reaction was exaggerated by the boot camp experience, during which the Marine Corps, especially among the services, tries to sever a recruit's ties to his or her previous life. But because of the nature of American society today, the re-entry shock upon leaving recruit training appears to be greater now than it was in the past. Asked to explain this difference, retired Marine Lieutenant General Bernard Traynor, T-R-A-I-N-O-R, said, quote, "When I got out of boot camp in 1946, society was different. It was more disciplined, and most Americans trusted the government. Most males had some military experience. It was an entirely different society, one that thought more about its responsibilities than its rights," unquote. Similarly, Sergeant Major James Moore, now retired, but at that time the senior sergeant on Paris Island, commented, quote, "It is difficult to go back into a society of what's in it for me when a Marine has been taught the opposite for so long. When I look at society today, I see a group of young people without direction because of the lack of teaching of moral values at home and in school. We see that when we get them in recruit training. The recruits are smarter today. They run rings around what we were able to do on average. Their problems are moral problems, lying, cheating, and stealing, and the very fact of being committed. We find that to get young people to dedicate themselves to a cause is difficult sometimes," unquote. By the way, I would add once again that I find that my own impressions of American society very much echo the perceptions of these military personnel. I feel much the same way, frankly. Continuing, "The idea of a gap between the military and civilian America is hardly new. For much of the nation's history," Samuel Huntington wrote in The Soldier and the State, 1957, "the U.S. military has had, quote, the outlook of an estranged minority," unquote. A decade ago, the journalist Arthur Hadley called this strained civilian-military relationship the Great Divorce. In The Straw Giant, Triumph and Failure, America's Armed Forces, 1986, he defined this as the, quote, "the less than amicable separation of the military from the financial, business, political, and intellectual elites of this country, particularly from the last two," unquote. The fact that most Americans pay attention to the military only when they see news of a sexual abuse scandal, such as the one at Aberdeen Proving Ground, underscores that separation. As far as media coverage is concerned, the U.S. military has fallen to the level of a mid-sized Asian nation that breaks onto the front page with a large disaster, but gets just a few paragraphs for bus plunges and plane crashes. The estrangement appears to be more complete now than it was in the past for, I think, two overarching reasons. First, more than 20 years after the end of conscription, the ignorance of American elites about the military has deepened. Second, with the end of the Cold War, the United States has entered into historically unexplored territory. If the Cold War is indeed considered to have been a kind of war, then for the first time in American history, the nation is maintaining a large military establishment during peacetime, with 1.5 million people on active duty and millions more serving in reserve and supporting civilian roles in the Defense Department and the defense industry. Several trends already underway in civilian society and in the post-Cold War military threaten to widen the gap in the coming years, further isolating and alienating the military. In his 1974 prologue to the revised edition of The Professional Soldier, Morris Janowitz concluded confidently that there would not be, quote, a return to earlier forms of a highly self-contained and socially distinct military force. The requirements of technology of education and of political support make this impossible, unquote. But the conditions that shaped the military of which Janowitz wrote no longer obtain. It now appears not only possible, but likely that over the next 20 years, the U.S. military will revert to a kind of garrison status, largely self-contained and increasingly distinct as a society and subculture. Quote, today, says retired Admiral Stanley Arthur, who commanded U.S. naval forces during the Gulf War, again quoting, the armed forces are no longer representative of the people they serve. More and more enlisted men and women, as well as officers, are beginning to feel that they are special, better than the society they serve. This is not healthy in an armed force serving in democracy, unquote. In this light, the Clinton administration's frictions with the military over gays in the armed forces, the alleged dissing, unquote, of a uniformed general by a White House aide, military resentment at the administration's ham-handedness in the latter phases of the Somalia mission, and military resistance to U.S. interventions in Haiti and Bosnia, can be seen not as the unique product of the personal histories of one president and his advisors, but as a precursor of future problems. The Harvard political scientist Michael Desch, D-E-S-C-H, concluded in a recent assessment of post-Cold War decision-making in the United States that civilians are now apparently less able, quote, to get the military to do what they want them to do, unquote, than they were during the Cold War. Three broad areas need to be examined to understand why this political, social, and cultural gap appears to be widening. Changes in the military, changes in civilian society, and changes in the international security environment. Next section is entitled Changes in the Military. By far the most important change that has taken place in the military is the termination of the draft in 1973. 24 years later, the consequences are still unfolding. Today, all 1.5 million people on active duty are volunteers. That fact carries vast implications for how the military operates and how it relates to society. In contrast to the post-Second World War demobilization, for example, the post-Cold War drawdown is being met with fierce resistance by many soldiers because all volunteered to be in the military and most are indeed fighting to stay in. Partly as a result of the end of conscription, the past 15 years especially has seen the rise of a professional military, even in the enlisted ranks. Although better trained as soldiers and more stable as a society, these professionals are very expensive because they bring with them families and all the attendant social infrastructure from health care to substance abuse counseling to higher education on military bases. John Luddy, L-U-D-D-Y, a Senate Republican aide, wrote that family-related costs to the Defense Department total more than $25 billion a year. This strong social safety net may not be sustained. With defense policy analysts in general agreement that a severe defense budget problem looms in the late 1990s, the military's vast social infrastructure is likely to come under attack by Congress. The military, especially the Army, which is the most vulnerable of the services in terms of personnel, faces a dilemma in addressing these cuts. The social safety net appears necessary to support a professional military with a high, quote, operating tempo, unquote. But to find the funds to maintain that net, the Army is likely to be required to take cuts in personnel far beyond what it will consider tolerable. Either course, curtailing support for personnel or curtailing personnel, is likely to engender resentment in the military. The post-draft professionalization of the military has also wrought cultural changes. Richard H. Cohn, KOHN, a former chief historian of the Air Force who now teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, argues that the officer corps has changed since the Cold War in the way it acts and feels. Quote, I sense an ethos that is different, he told me in an interview. They, again quoting, they talk about themselves as we, separate from society. They see themselves as different morally and culturally. It isn't the military of the 50s and 60s, which was a large, semi-mobilized citizen military establishment with a lot of younger officers who were there temporarily and a base of draftees, unquote. Change in the military culture aside, the American people have never been comfortable with professional militaries, as Huntington observed in The Soldier and the State, theirs or anybody else's, and any quotes from that book. The Revolutionary War was described as a war of citizen soldiers against the standing armies and mercenaries of George III. The Civil War was the Union fighting against the West Point-directed armies of the South. German militarism was the principal enemy in World War I. The professionals, in other words, are always on the other side. Then Ricks goes on to comment, a second major area of change in the military is the rebuilding that has occurred since the Vietnam War. In this area, as in many other aspects of defense nowadays, the Marine Corps appears to be exemplary. During the 1970s, the Corps was a disaster. Drug use was rampant and discipline ragged. There were 1,060 violent racial incidents in the Corps in 1970. Jeffrey Record noted in the May 1995 Proceedings, the magazine of the Navy's Professional Society, that during the Vietnam War, quote, the Corps registered rates of courts-martial, non-judicial punishments, unauthorized absences, and outright desertions unprecedented in its own history, and in most cases, 3 to 4 times those plaguing the U.S. Army. Violence and crime at recruit depots and other installations escalated. In some cases, officers ventured out only in pairs or groups and only in daylight. And then Ricks goes on to comment, today the Marine Corps has drastically reduced its discipline problems. Its drug problem, too, is minor, with less than 4% of Marines testing positive in random urinalysis. Although racial tension still exists in the military, the services, especially the Army, have probably done about as good a job of minimizing the issue of race as is possible in the American context. In the Army's officer corps of 78,000, there are now some 9,000 blacks. As Charles Moskos, M-O-S-K-O-S, a military sociologist at Northwestern University, has observed, the U.S. military is still the only place in American society where it is routine for black people to boss around white people. This may be one reason the black drill instructor has become a stock figure in American popular culture, not only in films such as Private Benjamin, An Officer and a Gentleman, Major Payne, Renaissance Man, and in the Army Now, but also in commercials for beer and long-distance telephone services. In addition, two related post-Cold War trends having to do with the military's infrastructure may have had important consequences for civilian-military relations. These are the processes of closing unneeded bases and the privatization of many functions of logistics and maintenance. The many base closings may increase the geographical and political isolation of the military, or, to put it another way, we may return the military to its pre-Second World War condition. Quote, before World War II, the majority of the military posts were located in the South and in the West, unquote, Janowitz notes. Also earlier in this century, the South was disproportionately represented in the ranks of senior officers. In 1910, some 90% of Army generals had a, quote, Southern affiliation, unquote, Janowitz reports. The closing of bases has so far hit especially hard in the far West and the Northeast, areas that are both more liberal and more expensive to live in and operate in than the rest of the nation. The move to privatize much of the military's huge depot structure, the network that maintains aircraft, vehicles, and other defense gear, may also contribute to the social and political isolation of the military. Faced with the need to cut personnel and seeking to preserve its warfighting tooth, unquote, the post-Cold War military has sought to privatize much of its support, quote, tail, unquote. This privatization, which promises to reduce the number of soldiers in civilian occupations, is occurring not only on U.S. soil, where maintenance work is being farmed out to corporations, but also in other countries where U.S. soldiers operate. In Somalia, Haiti, and Bosnia, for example, Brown and Root has performed a host of functions once done or at least supervised by the uniformed military, from staffing mess halls to purifying water to preparing the bodies of soldiers killed in firefights for shipment home. A concern relating to extensive civilian contracting is that military personnel today are less likely to be serving in occupations that have civilian equivalents and are more likely to specialize in military skills that are neither transferable to the civilian sector nor well understood by civilians. These isolating trends are occurring amid broader cultural changes in the military, notably the politicization of the officer corps. Of course, military culture has always had a conservative streak, just as journalism has always had an element of anti-authoritarianism. I suspect, however, that today's officers are both more conservative and more politically active than their predecessors. Admittedly, the evidence is hazy and the data are skimpy, in part because, quote, conservative, unquote, is almost impossible to define. Nonetheless, the few indications available today are strikingly at odds with the conclusions Janowitz reached. Janowitz found that many officers continued to avoid open party preferences, but also detected a trend toward more liberals among military officers. He found the military becoming more representative of society, with a long-term upward trend in the number of officers, quote, willing to deviate from traditional conservative identification, unquote. And he detected a correlation between higher ranks and greater intensity of conservative attitudes. Today, the available evidence indicates that all these trends have reversed. The military appears to be becoming less representative of society, with a long-term downward trend in the number of officers willing to identify themselves as liberal. Open identification with the Republican Party is becoming the norm, and the few remaining liberals in uniform tend to be colonels and generals, perhaps because they began their careers in the draft-era military. The junior officer corps, apart from its female and minority members, appears to be overwhelmingly hard-right Republican and largely comfortable with the views of Rush Limbaugh. Air Force Colonel Charles Dunlap observed in a recent essay published by the Air Force Academy, quote, "Many officers privately expressed delight that, as a result of the controversy over gays in the military, the Reserve Officers Training Corps program is producing, quote, fewer officers from the more liberal campuses to challenge the Air Force officers' increasingly right-wing philosophy," unquote. A variety of recent formal and informal surveys point towards those conclusions. Midshipmen at Annapolis, who in 1974 were similar in their politics to their peers at civilian colleges, are now twice as likely as other students to consider themselves conservative, according to an unpublished internal naval survey. Quote, "The shift to the right has been rather remarkable, even while there has been an infusion of rather more liberal women and minorities," unquote, one of the study's conductors concluded. Former Army Major Dana Isakoff, ISAACOFF, who taught at West Point in the early 1990s, routinely surveyed her students on their politics, assessing about 60 of them during each of 6 semesters. In a typical section, she reported in a talk last year at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, 17 would identify themselves as Republican, but none would label themselves as Democratic or Independent, instead choosing the traditional course of adopting no political label. She concluded that to today's West Point cadets, being a Republican is part of the definition of being a military officer. Quote, "Students overwhelmingly identified themselves as conservatives," unquote, she said. Here, the definition of conservatism is important. This does not appear to be the compromising, solution-oriented politics of, say, Bob Dole. Quote, "There is a tendency among the cadets to adopt the mainstream conservative attitudes and push them to extremes," unquote, Isakoff said, again quoting, "The Democratic-controlled Congress was public enemy number one. Number two was the liberal media. They firmly believed in the existence of the welfare queen," unquote. This tendency toward right-wing attitudes is not limited to malleable students at military academies. A 1995 survey of Marine officers at Quantico, a large base in Virginia that focuses on training officers, found similar views. The Marines are not the most representative example, but because they are the most tradition-bound and unabashedly culturally conservative of the services, they are the most dramatic. They should be viewed as an indicator not of where the U.S. military is today, but of where it is heading. The Corps was less altered by the Cold War than any of the other services. With the end of the Cold War, the other services are becoming more like the Marines, smaller, insular, and expeditionary. In the Quantico survey, 50% of the new officers studying at the basic school identified themselves as conservatives. In a parallel survey of mid-career officers at the Command and Staff College, 69% identified themselves as conservatives. In a striking indication of alienation from civilian society, an overwhelming proportion of the basic school lieutenants, 81%, said that the military's values are closer to the values of the founding fathers than are the values of civilian society. At the Command and Staff College, where students generally have at least 10 years of military experience, 64% agreed with that statement. A majority of officers at both schools agreed that a gap exists between the military and civilian society and stated that they expect it to increase with the passage of time. Fewer than half believed it desirable to have people with different political views within their organizations. Quote, "I believe that these results indicate the potential for a serious problem in civil-military relations for the United States," unquote, concluded Army Major Robert A. Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N, who conducted this survey of Marine officers and analyzed the responses. Quote, "Instead of viewing themselves as the representatives of society," unquote, he wrote, again quoting, "the participating officers believe they are a unique element within society," unquote. Again, officers today appear to be not only more conservative than those in the past, but also more active in politics, both in how they describe themselves and in how they vote. This change is all the more striking because traditionally, The American military has avoided political involvement. And we're going to continue with this article in the next half-hour segment. All of these half-hour segments all of the other programs I produce, the various interviews that I've done, the weekly One Step Beyond shows from home base station KFJC-FM, the archive shows, and most of the tapes of lectures that I've given are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. Their mailing address is P.O. Box 1179, P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, that's A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. Once again, the email address, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. A list of and descriptions of all of the programs available from Spitfire can be viewed on the KFJC webpage. Point your web browser at www.kfjc.org. Once again, that's www.kfjc.org, and look in the Public Affairs section. The first, and due to financial problems, possibly the only issue of other means of publication I've begun is now out and is available at various retail outlets. There is a website available for other means, and you can get to that from the KFJC website. Again, other means is a political literary digest, and due to the fact of financial problems, I am foregoing any profits I might have made from that, so I can announce this on the air. People should check with local retail outlets for other means, which is now on sale. We're going to continue with our analysis and a reading of this Atlantic Monthly article, again from July of 1997, in the next half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.